I'm going to go ahead and introduce Professor Anino. He is a professor at the Florida State University College of Law, where he teaches at the Child Advocacy Center. He specializes in children's issues and disability law. Those of you in the Second Circuit and probably in other areas of the state are very familiar with him and with his work. He's been very helpful to our program and done a number of trainings for us previously. He has practiced law for more than 20 years, and he's the attorney of record for more than 500 appellate cases in state and federal court. He has extensive trial and administrative law background and was the chair of the public interest law section of the Florida Bar, and is presently on the Executive Council of the Public Interest Law Section and is editor-in-chief of the Florida Bar Public Interest Law Reporter. He's published a number of articles and gives trainings on Medicaid issues and other issues related to children and to disability law throughout the state. So it's my pleasure now to hand it over to Professor Anino.
Thank you. My name is Paolo Anino. I'm happy to be here today, and I'm also happy that this is a telephone conference rather than a video conference, because my office is a total mess, so I wouldn't want you to see that. But what we're going to talk about today is Medicaid, and Medicaid is also called Title 19. So Title 19, Medicaid, means the same thing. I'm going to give a basic overview of the Medicaid system, and I'm focusing my talk on practitioners in the foster care system, so guardian ad litem and others who advocate for children in the foster care system, what guardian ad litem need to know about the Medicaid system. Medicaid is super complex, but my goal in today's talk is to bring out just the points that I think you need to know as advocates. And I'll be talking approximately 50 minutes, and then we'll have 10 minutes or so for questions. Okay, to begin, what is Medicaid? Well, Medicaid is a national health insurance policy for select groups. It is something we're doing right in this country, in the sense that here is a nationalized program that covers all poor children. So poor children are covered under Medicaid. Who else are covered under Medicaid? SSI children, children who receive supplemental security income. They're also covered automatically by Medicaid. So if you receive SSI, you automatically receive Medicaid. Who else is covered? Foster children. Foster children are also covered by Medicaid. Then recently, there's been some changes on state law on this issue, but children who are in the foster care system and who exit the system, they what we call it, children who age out of the foster care system. Now, all children who age out of the foster care system up to the age of until they're 20 years old are covered by Medicaid. So that whole new population, kids who are in the foster care system, they age out. Now that group also is covered by Medicaid. And then we have children who are also in the Road to Independence program. Again, the Road to Independence program, and that group of children are in Medicaid until 21. So just to summarize here, we have large groups of children who are covered by Medicaid. Now, what does Medicaid cost? What's the cost of Medicaid? Well, from the perspective of the child, it doesn't cost anything at all. So there's no copayment, there's no premiums. So from that perspective, it's a great program. Now, what does Medicaid cover? Well, Medicaid is a very comprehensive medical program covering rehabilitative and habilitation services. So it's hard to imagine what Medicaid does not cover. So Medicaid is a very broad, extensive health insurance program. It is probably better than the health insurance program your own program is offering you. So it's a very broad program, covers most medical and also life-needing services. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. Now, generally, why should a guardian ad litem attorney or advocate care about Medicaid? Well, first thing is, in dependency courts throughout the state and throughout the country. What do advocates always argue for? Advocates argue for services. And what do we always hear from the department and community-based agencies? Well, the lack of funding for services. So how does Medicaid help? Well, Medicaid can pay for many of the services that you are requesting from the department and from the community-based agencies. So it's not a good argument when DCF or others argue that they don't simply have the funding, because there is funding, and the funding is from Medicaid for many of the services. And we'll go into more details later on. So it covers many of the services. What else? It's really important. Every child who is abused, neglected, or abandoned, who is picked up and goes through the shelter process, within 72 hours, again, within 72 hours after the child is in custody, they're required by state law to be screened for health services. And specifically, it's going to be screened for Medicaid services. So every child who's in the system right at the beginning, at the shelter stage, within 72 hours of custody, the department is required, through one of its contractors, of course, to provide Medicaid screening. There is one exception. The exception is if the child is taken away from a home and then placed within the 72 hours back in the same home, then that child is not required to be provided Medicaid screening. But any other circumstance, emergency shelters, relative placement, non-relative placements, all those are required to have Medicaid screening. And in my outline, I specifically cite to the statutes and the regulations and the cases, so that's where you can get those sites from that authorize that. Again, what's another reason why advocates require knowledge about Medicaid? I think one of the other reasons is that children who age out of the foster care system are now eligible for Medicaid. And I think it's part of our job to make sure we inform these children who are aging out that they still have Medicaid, either until 20 or 21, depending on the program they're in. Okay. That's a fast overview of Medicaid. Sometimes people confuse Medicaid with Medicare. Medicare is an insurance program. It's totally different. It's part of everyone here probably will be participating in Medicare at a certain age. Medicaid is an entitlement program. It requires you have to be a member of a select group. And when I talk about those groups, either poor children, SSI, foster children, children exiting the foster care system, or in order to obtain Medicaid. Okay. And that's very different from Medicare. Again, one's an entitlement, one is not an entitlement. Next, I want to talk about a program that's within Medicaid, and that program is called Early and Periodic Screening, Diagnosis, and Treatment. Early and Periodic Screening, Diagnosis, and Treatment. Advocates usually call it EPSDT, Early and Periodic Screening and Diagnosis and Treatment. What is EPSDT? Well, the main thing I want to stress is this is the program within Medicaid that's going to help most of your children. It is part of Medicaid. Every child who has Medicaid automatically receives Early and Periodic Screening, Diagnosis, and Treatment, EPSDT. It is a mandatory program. Does not require any type of separate application. So when a person is requesting Medicaid services, they can automatically receive EPSDT services. Again, what is special about Early and Periodic Screening, Diagnosis, and Treatment? What is special about this program? It is a medical health insurance package that provides much greater services than Medicaid provides for adults who are on Medicaid. So you obtain more services through early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment. What does EPSDT provide? Well, it provides dental services. So if a child needs his braces or needs some types of special dental work, it provides dental services of whatever type. Physical, occupational, speech therapies are all provided through EPSDT. Personal care services. So if the child needs some type of assistance at home or in a foster care, EPSDT would provide it. Transportation services will also be provided by EPSDT. Case management services will also be provided by EPSDT. Inpatient psychiatric hospital services, again, will be provided by EPSDT. It is extremely broad, and that's what I want to stress here. What is the standard for obtaining EPSDT services? Well, first is the child has to be in Medicaid. Okay, that's, and again, we talked in the beginning, a child is eligible for Medicaid if there are poor children, SSI children, foster care children, or all youths exiting the foster care system. So poor children, SSI children, foster care children, and youth exiting the foster care system are all children who are eligible for EPSDT. Now, how do you obtain EPSDT? What is the standard? The standard is it has to be medically necessary to correct or ameliorate a condition discovered by screening. What does that mean? Medically necessary to correct or ameliorate a condition discovered by screening. The way the process works is early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment. The emphasis is on screening, so that the child will be screened for different health conditions. In specific, we're talking about vision, hearing, physical conditions, and emotional conditions. So hearing, vision, physical, and emotional conditions. And during the screening, if the doctor finds any type of condition that can be corrected or ameliorated, then the doctor is required to order that treatment, and Medicaid is required to provide that treatment. Now, of course, that treatment has to be what's called medically necessary. Now, I want to spend a few minutes. Prior to 2005, medically necessary here in Florida was a very strict term, very difficult to meet the standard for medically necessary. However, in a really major case that was litigated by Florida Legal Services, it's called C period F period versus DCF 934 Southern 2nd 1, Florida 3rd DCA 2005. Again, C period F period versus DCF 934 Southern 2nd 1, page 1, 3rd DCA 2005. In the CF decision, the issue was, what does medically necessary mean in the context of early and periodic screening and diagnosis and treatment? The court gave a very broad definition of medically necessary, such that the court said that the definition that was used by DCF was way too narrow. Therefore, the federal definition preempts the state definition, and therefore, most services can be now argued as long as during the screening it would correct or ameliorate a condition discovered by the doctor, then EPSDT services are authorized. Again, for an excellent discussion of that whole issue of what is authorized, I recommend C period, F period versus DCF 934, Southern 2nd, page 1. Okay, now to continue, So now I talked about generally what Medicaid is and who's eligible for Medicaid. Then I talked about one of the major programs, EPSDT, and I talked about that as long as a service is medically necessary, but now in the context of EPSDT, that's very broad based on Florida case law, as long as it corrects or ameliorates a situation, a condition, then that condition is authorized. The next program I want to talk about now is called, and there's been a lot of litigation on this program in Florida, called Home and Community-Based Care Waivers. And that's a totally different program. It's a waiver program. Medicaid has several waiver programs. The waiver program I'm talking about today is the Home and Community-Based Care Waivers. This program will be relevant to advocates for children in foster care when they represent children with developmental disabilities. So when you have a child who has a developmental disability, mental retardation, cerebral palsy, etc., then home and community-based care waivers are relevant to your advocacy. What is a home and community-based waiver? It is a super Medicaid or a Medicaid Plus. It provides much more services than is provided for adults who are in regular Medicaid. I recommend a case that my office here at the law school handles. And that case is called Russell v. Agency for Persons with Disabilities. Russell v. Agency for Persons with Disabilities, 929 Southern 2nd, 601, 1st DCA, 2006. Russell v. Agency for Persons with Disabilities, 9 Southern 2nd, 601, Florida, 1st DCA, 2006. And in that decision, there's a very lengthy discussion of Medicaid waivers. The Amber Russell case is somewhat typical. Here was a child who was developmentally delayed in the foster care system. She was an abused child in the system for a long time. She's what we call a dual diagnostic child, meaning that she had both severe psychiatric problems and also severe, or I should say, she also had profound mental retardation issues. So she was both developmentally delayed and she had psychiatric problems. In that case, she needed a number of services, such as intensive behavioral services. Also, she needed types of services, companion services to help her at home, and she needed personal care assistance of a variety of types. So the child needed a variety of different services, and regular Medicaid at that point and DCF at that point was not able to provide her those services. So we applied for a home and community-based waiver. And now, where do you apply for? These types of waivers are applied for at this point in time for agency, the Agency for Persons with Disability. That's a new state agency that happened roughly a year or so ago. The Agency for Persons with Disabilities. And there's been, so we applied for the waiver, and there's approximately, oh, it varies. The numbers go for anywhere from 11,000 to 15,000 people waiting for one of the home and community-based waivers. Well, as you know, as a practical matter, the child, Amber Russell, for example, would have never received the intensive behavioral services and companion services that she needed if she was just waiting on that line. I think she was number 13,800 or something like that. So what occurred? Well, the big issue is how do you get jumped up on the waiting list? How do you get in front of the waiting list? Well, there's two ways. First is if you can prove what's called crisis. Crisis is a technical term, and there are three basic ways of proving crisis. One is danger to yourself or others. Two is the child is going to become homeless. Three is the child caretaker can no longer take care of the child. So danger to yourself or others is number one. Two is homelessness. And three is the caretaker can no longer take care of the child. Well, in the case of Amber Russell, we showed that that she was going to be a danger to herself and others. And the way we did that is she was Baker-acted half a dozen times. She was Baker-acted. She was arrested numerous times for violent acts. She was running away a number of times. And we documented and created a package proving that she was a danger to herself and others. And that is ultimately how we were able to establish that she's eligible for a crisis. And crisis simply means that she gets placed in front of the others 15,000. And now today, Amber does have a Medicaid waiver. In another case, we're handling, this child's name is Precious. In the case of Precious, very similar circumstance. The child has been Baker-acted many different times. She's been charged with many different juvenile offenses for violence, and we were able to prove that she was a danger to herself and others. And again, we submitted the package that crisis, there's a crisis instrument that you fill out and you attach your documents to that instrument specifying how the child meets the standard for a crisis. And so one way then children who are in the foster care system are obtaining home and community-based waivers who are developmentally delayed is by proving crisis. Now the other way of jumping in front of the list is through something called is through Florida statutes. And this is some of the work that was done by Andrea Moore and others, but Andrea Moore taking the lead with Florida Children First. She did a great job here. And what she did was, and her colleagues, they were able to have a law passed in Florida, Florida Statutes 393.065, parentheses 5, Florida Statutes 393.065, parentheses 5, which says that children who are in the foster care system, specifically it says, with the exception of clients deemed to be in crisis, whom the agency self-serve as described in rule, the agency shall place at the top of its list for waiver services those children on the wait list who are from the child welfare system. Again, the agency shall place at the top of its wait list for waiver services those children on the wait list who are from the child welfare system. And that's very broad child welfare system. So it doesn't just limit it to children in foster care. It would also apply to children who are in relative placements, kinship care, etc. And what that statute does now, it says that those children who are in the system should be moved from whatever thousands, whatever number they are, to the front of that 15,000 or so list. How many children are we talking about in the state of Florida? Well, we're talking about, there's a debate on this, roughly anywhere from 400 children to 700 children are presently on that huge waiting list who are in the foster care system. And all those children need advocacy because those children need, we need to make sure that they are moved from the bottom of the list to the front of the list, and therefore obtain their needed services. Just to summarize here, there's two ways then of jumping up on the front of the list. One is by proving crisis, and we talked about that a minute ago, danger to yourself or others, homelessness, or caretaker can't handle you, or through Florida Statutes 393.065, parentheses 5, where by statute the department is required to provide the push to move those children from the bottom of the list to the front. What does a waiver provide? Well, a waiver, the first thing is, what's great about a Medicaid waiver, the first thing, every child who has a Medicaid waiver obtains a support coordinator. Now, they privatize these individuals. So they're private individuals, independent contractors, to provide the case management required for the services under the Medicaid waiver. And what occurs is the child and his or her advocate obtains a list of support coordinators from the agency for persons with disabilities and is required to pick from that list a support coordinator. Then the support coordinator's job is not to provide any what I call direct services. What the support coordinator's job is to facilitate and coordinate all the different services the child needs that will be paid for under the Medicaid waiver. And how that's taken care of is through something called a support plan. So once a year, the support coordinator, working with the child and the guardian and the advocates, create a support plan. And it's really important that this is something called child-centered, meaning the support coordinator will turn to the child and specifically ask the child what he or she wants, what services he or she needs, and will go over the variety of services that can be provided to the child. When I think of the home and community-based waiver versus regular Medicaid, what I think about is that regular Medicaid pays for rehabilitative services, services to make someone well, whereas the home and community-based care waiver provides habilitation services, services that allow someone to live in the community, allow someone to live and flourish in their without being institutionalized. And I think that's the key point. The point of home and community-based waivers is to prevent institutionalization. It's to prevent institutionalization. And so to prevent children from being locked up into any of these institutions, it's for the child to live in the community. So these are services that allow the child to live in the community. So that's why one of the services is called companion services, where you'll have someone who will be hired to take the child to the mall or other places, or kitchen aid services, help the child with making his or her food, or a variety of other types of services that allows the child to live at home or in the community. So again, how that's all taken care of, it's through the support coordinator. There's always, anytime there's a Medicaid waiver, there's a support coordinator. And then it's done through a support plan, and it is much broader than simply services that are rehabilitative. Okay. Let me talk now. That was kind of a fast overview, probably a little too fast even, on Medicaid, EPSDT, Medicaid waiver. Let me bring up a couple legal points. There's been much litigation going on about, okay, a person applies for a Medicaid waiver and is denied. Okay, what type of hearing is that person entitled to once they're denied a Medicaid waiver? Well, the answer now is in Florida. And Children's First took the lead on this issue in Florida. The answer now is that person has the right to a formal Department of Administrative hearing. So a formal DOA hearing is now authorized. Prior to 2006, the department was providing was called fair hearings, where you had non-lawyers as the hearing officers. There were informal hearings with non-lawyers. That was challenged. J period M period versus APD, 938 Southern 2nd, 53 Florida 1st DCA, 2006. Again, J period M period versus APD, 1st DCA decision, 2006. Now a person has the right to a formal administrative hearing. So what we've done today then is we talked about Medicaid. That's a generalized health insurance program for all poor children. We talked about a specific program within Medicaid, EPSDT, which provides extra services for children who are in Medicaid. And then we talked about a special Medicaid program called Home and Community-Based Care Waivers. And that's for children who are developmentally delayed. At this point, I think I would like to open it up for some questions. Otherwise, I'll just give some more examples. Does anyone have any questions out there?
Professor, you know, this is Mary Kay.
Hi, Mary Kay.
I have just a really basic question, but I apologize for asking it, but I have yet to, what is required for this Medicaid screening? Can a caseworker do that, or is there any definition in the code for what the requirements are for that?
Yes, there is. And that's an excellent question. Let me just repeat one of the comments I made earlier. Within 72 hours, and this is very strict, within 72 hours that child is placed within shelter in the custody department, within 72 hours, the child is required to have an EPSDT screening. It is required to be done by a health professional. And there's details about the screening that actually it just can't be that a doctor just or a nurse just looks at the child. They have to remove the child's clothing. They go to that level of detail. It has to be a full screening dealing with hearing, vision, emotional, and physical. And what's important with that is that the screening is all part of something called, and this is not part of Medicaid, but part of healthcare, something called the child resource record. The child resource record. So that screening becomes part of the child's resource record, and that child resource record, by the way, that for people who want to learn more about child resource record, that's Florida Administrative Code 65C-13.016. 65C-13.016. And it discusses child resource record. And the child resource record, or the abbreviation is CRR, the child resource record, follows the child. You know, it's a child's health passport. It goes with the foster care parent. It goes to the emergency shelter. And it specifically specifies what the child's medical condition and what the child needs and who the child providers are. One thing I noticed in my practice here, and my students noticed, that many foster parents or emergency shelter caretakers simply are not aware of the child's resource record. But the department, or in this case, or the community-based agency, is required to make sure that the foster care parent has a copy of the child resource record, which has all that information. Let me give you an example. A child was in a placement in South Florida. It was in Tampa area. And gets moved to the foster care system, gets moved to a placement, to a group home in Tallahassee. The child loses his glasses, his eyeglasses, during the placement. Again, that's, eyeglasses are specifically authorized by Medicaid EPSDT. And what should have occurred in that case was simply the caseworker scheduled an appointment for the child to have his vision examined, and then at that point obtain a new pair of glasses. In the case I'm mentioning right now, it took several months before that actually occurred, and the reason for that was not because of Medicaid, was simply because of case management, that it wasn't done by the caseworker in that case. So a lot of times what the advocate's role is to make sure that these children do receive the services as authorized by statutes and rules. So again, EPSDT should be done by, to answer your question directly, by a health professional. It's required to be done without an actual physical examination. And the way EPSDT works is for the first several months of the child's birth, there's an actual schedule when the child should be coming in. Then after between 7 and 18, I believe, then every exact period of time, I think it's every 2 years between that, the child receives a full physical at that time. So the answer is that this is a great way of providing services to children. And I think many children are not receiving their Medicaid services. Sometimes it is Medicaid's mistake or fault, but many times the reason why they're not receiving the services is simply that case managers are not doing it and the advocates are simply not aware of it.